Everybody, welcome back to the Insiders Lounge. Today we're in a new setup, and I'm in Naples, Florida at the moment, but I've got another special guest. Mika, thanks for joining me, and feel free to introduce yourself.
Chad, thank you for the introduction. Very happy to be here with you. My name is Mika Elovara, and I am the head assistant coach for the Richmond Kickers USL League One team and also the director of player development and methodology for the club.
So we'll get things started from the beginning of your journey. How did you first get involved with football, and tell me a little bit about your childhood?
Oh, man. In some ways, it's probably like a typical European soccer crazy childhood. I grew up in a town called Oulu in Finland, and the two main sports in the town are ice hockey and soccer. And if you're a kid growing up in the town, you're very likely to actually play both. You know, whether you formally join a club or whatever, but you know, your pastime is those two sports, or at least used to be back in the day. And so I was surrounded by kids like-minded like myself and fell in love with the sport, and actually really fell in love with sports. I mean, I played basketball also growing up but soccer was always my number one passion. I do think that it matters in terms of my actual later career in the sport. Where I grew up or who I was surrounded by, because I was surrounded by kids with similar dreams, similar ambitions, and then coaches who wanted to help us get there. So, you know, from my early childhood memories, I watched soccer on TV. I played soccer all the time, and we had some of the local pro players. You know, they were very accessible, I guess is the right way to put it, because there would be times where they would just spend time with the youth on the fields and you know, show little moves or you know, show you some things about technique or whatever. And then, you know, some of my earliest memories of watching like an actually really intense game was when Liverpool visited my hometown and played the club that had won the national championship, and I was like 4 or 5 years old. So from there, you know, how do you explain why you love something? I mean, part of it is the original fall in love with the sport, and then the rest is probably, you know, where you are and who you're with.
And then in terms of your playing career, how far did you make it, and kind of what were some of the experiences like along the way?
Yeah, so along the same vein, you know, in terms of my playing career, I played in Finland up until the time that I came to the United States for college. And Finland is a small country, but in Europe, the structures work very similarly everywhere. So I was fortunate that I was in a very high-level environment in terms of player development. I was playing in the academy. I was playing with players who ended up going and having, you know, far more illustrious careers than I ever did, playing in the Bundesliga, playing in the EPL, playing for Finland, you know, dozens of caps. Again, in my hometown, there's a legacy of winning and development. And, you know, in the academy, we won the national championship 3 years out of the four that I was there. I made my first team debut at 17, had some very exciting games as a teenager. Again, playing with guys that I grew up looking up to, or playing with some of my academy teammates on the first team. But when I graduated from high school, I made the, I think, especially at that time, I made the more unusual choice, and I decided to cross the ocean and come here for college instead of continuing the pure pro path, if you will, where most of my teammates did. I came here for college. I went to UNC Wilmington. And when I now think back on the process of getting recruited to go, and I know what's available to the young players now in terms of exposure and communication with college coaches, I really laugh at that, my own experience, because, you know, back in the days of VHS tapes and actual letters and everything, me choosing where to go for college was quite the process. But very happy with what I decided, and that's the early part of my player career. And then after college, I went back to Finland, played another six seasons, and Retired in 2003, and started to look into, or not look into, but started to kind of transition into coaching. So,
and then we've had quite a few guests who are international students in terms of they played an academy level in their home country and then moved to the States for collegiate level.
Right.
What was some of the initial interests? Like, what made you actually want to do that? Especially, I think now it's become a little bit more common with the globalization and the fact that you can see multiple players going over at the same time. But I think back 100%. Then it definitely wasn't as common. So where did you have that first interest to actually approach the idea of coming to the US?
So I think it's twofold. You know, like I said, you know, I was in an environment where I was definitely given every opportunity to pursue just like, hey, you want to try to become a pro, keep going. But I was raised primarily by a single mom and a big sister, and education was always highlighted as the number one thing. And it's very interesting. Like I was telling you about the influences of some of the pro players. My older sister, she was also an athlete, and through her network of friends, I also got to talk to a lot of the kind of the aspiring pros and the pros in the hockey and the soccer world. And in my conversations with many of them, even the ones who'd made it, including NHL draft picks and everything, they would also remind me of the importance of education. Because you never know when the career ending injury might happen, or you never know what might happen, and you don't make it at the level where you dream to make it. So again, it's the people that I was surrounded by, and I'm very grateful that I was surrounded by good influences. And you know, combined with the way I was raised, education was always there as the number one thing. So that definitely influenced it. And then there was a couple of guys in my hometown, older ages, like 4 years older than I am, who had also done that in terms of leave Finland, go to the States, go to college and play. And those two combined really were kind of the inspiration for me to do that. And again, like I never thought that I would forego my dreams. It was just a different path. You know, I still knew, I mean, making my debut as a 17-year-old center back was super exciting. And it was hard in some ways to decide, well, look, I've already played and I could continue here. But if I stay here, combining education and high level sport is just not feasible, because the structures in society are just not wired that way. Your professors don't care about you as an athlete. Mm. Your coaches most often don't care about you being a student. So, you know, that's ultimately the reason why I decided to come over. But I never felt like, well, I'm compromising. I just felt like it's going to be a different path.
So you spoke about that balance between your professors and your coaches. How did you actually find that balance of the educational side and playing in the collegiate level?
Oh, it was great. I mean, I loved it. I thought it was very easy for me. I mean, when I came over, I don't think I needed to really change anything, because again, like from the soccer perspective, I had been developing in a professional environment for the past several years. And then I had always been a good student. So just combining the two became very easy for me. And it was really relieving, because, you know, you were at a setting where, you know, you have people in each area who want you to succeed. So I really enjoyed the college setting for me as a player. There's no question about it.
And then while we're on the college side of things, your educational background, I think it's safe to say, is quite impressive. You have, I want to make sure I get this right. You have your bachelor's degree, your master's, and your PhD now. Can you kind of talk through the three different levels and the degrees that you have?
Yeah, correct. My levels of education are really kind of, I think they're indicative of the way I've been since I was a kid, because it's really, I always wanted to be the best I can be at anything. So, you know, if it's the world of academics, if you get to a PhD, then formally you've been educated at the highest possible level. I never specifically had a goal of, I want to get this so that I can get that. It was just the thirst and the hunger for knowledge that I had. So I knew when I got my undergraduate that I would probably one day I would want to go and get my graduate degrees, both my master's and PhD. So I graduated from UNC Wilmington, and my degree was in English language and literature. And I was actually, while I was an undergraduate, there were times where I was a substitute teacher for some of the professors. So it was actually a really cool experience. Mm. And that was part of the spark for me that, you know, I was still very much a player. I was still very much, you know, thinking once I'm graduated, then it's time for me to really focus on being the player and seeing how much the game is still going to give to me. How much am I going to be able to give to the game? But I think that was kind of the early spark for education or for me as an educator. Fast forward a couple of years and I had my mandatory military service out of the way because all men have to serve in the military in Finland. I'm on the road with the team and I'm thinking like, I have all this time and I was like, well, I might as well just start getting going with my master's degree already because, again, being in the American undergraduate setting, I was very used to combining the intellectual academic pursuit of excellence and then the same thing on the field in the right times of the day. So I finished my master's while I was still playing, and then I started my PhD journey 6 months after I had retired, and then it took me another 3 years to finish my PhD. So,
and then one of the key questions I always like to ask is a lot of people, for example, some might look at your bachelor's degree and see that you have an English background and go, how does that translate to what you're doing now? But mm-hmm. Can you sort of explain sort of the different degrees and it might not necessarily be the educational side, but also just the experience for teaching, for example, would help translate to coaching. And I think you can have a lot of those experiences kind of go back and forth. But what were some of those key lessons that you were able to bring into your day-to-day now?
Yeah, I mean, no question for me. First of all, I just recently had the conversation probably with a fellow parent because, my wife and I have three children and the middle one is just about, 1 foot out the door. She's going to college in the summer. So we've fairly recently talked about majors and talked about, pursuits of careers and dreams and everything. And I was having a conversation and I said that despite the world changing so much in the last 20 years, I think the English major, a major in humanities is always going to be relevant. And then it just comes down to what you're actually going to do with it. As you said, it's probably not going to be straightforward for a lot of people. As it wasn't for me, but in terms of how my background in the humanities prepared me for what I'm doing. I mean, I think it's the combination of my experience in the sport as a player. And we can talk about that later in terms of what's really shaped my coaching. But it's humanities and coaching is man management and human development. So, the ability to analyze, to think critically, to be able to communicate effectively and understand the human mind and the humankind. I mean, I think those are all really, really important tools for a coach. If you're too narrow-minded, if you're too narrowly thinking, if you're too soccer-focused only, I don't think you have the same level of success and longevity as a coach. Can you get success? Of course. Can you have longevity? Yes. But in terms of the level where I think it can be, I think you need to have the human aspect very much ingrained in everything you do. And for me, it's the skills you learn for, how do you research things? How do you analyze and synthesize things? I mean, there's so much that we could probably go on for a longer tangent, but I'll save everybody's time right now.
No, that's great. I think it gives a good idea of, even though you did a degree that is not necessarily related directly to footballing, but you can find different ways to bring that into your day-to-day work now.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
And then, so you finished your studies, you went back to Finland and you spent some time there playing. What was the transition getting into coaching? Did you always have that interest to move on to coaching after you were done your playing career, or was it something that happened suddenly?
Yeah, I always had an idea that I think I'll want to be a coach one day. There's no question about that. It actually got pretty annoying because my last couple of years of playing, two different coaches that I played for growing up in the academy were really, they were in the director roles and they were saying like, hey, you know, we want to get you involved in coaching. You know, you've always been a leader on the teams, you know, and you know, you're going to be a good coach one day. And it started to be annoying because I was like, I know I think I may want to coach, but you got to let me finish being a player first. And I never during my coaching career, I never picked up a kind of a side job as a coach. I wanted to focus on me being the player. And then I, you know, I felt that once I'm done as a player, I'm going to be done. And then it's time for me to see if the, you know, if coaching is what I want to do. But as far as the transition goes, after retiring, I told myself I need to take some time away because, you know, you get to 28 years old and or 29 and the game has dictated everything you do in life up until then, since I can remember, like 4 or 5 years old. And I told myself and I told my wife that it's time to see what my new relationship with the game is going to be. I think I want to coach, but I don't know that. And I want to see first how much I missed the game. And then so I took some months away from the game. I mean, I didn't need many days that I actually knew how much I missed the game and being involved in it. But I stuck to my decision in terms of intentionally forced to be away from the game, to know that I absolutely want to be back in the game. During that time, you know, I would get phone calls from clubs saying like, hey, you know, are you sure you're retired? You know, we could use an experienced center back or six. You know, I got some phone calls where, you know, a former coach of mine would ask like, hey, you want to become and be like a team manager? And, you know, and I was like, absolutely not. If I'm going to be on the bus, it's going to be either as a player or as a coach. I will not sit on the bus without any kind of role within the technical side of things. So those are, of course, always flattering. It's whenever somebody thinks that you would be a good fit for their organization, you know, I think you must be grateful. And it's always flattering to know that people would want you for a role, but they were not for me. I was not going to be a guy who's going to make a comeback after you're done. And I needed to just figure out what it is that I want to do with the game. So that's kind of how the transition went. And then I was fortunate that I was offered a U17 Academy boys coaching job straight away, working for my former academy director, who had a very strong influence on who I became as a player. And then because of that, of course, has had an influence on me as a coach as well. So started coaching for the club that I grew up playing for and was very grateful and proud to be offered the really the key position in terms of developing players for future first team.
And you kind of had this story of going back and forth over the ocean. It felt like Finland, US, back and forth. So you finally did it one more time in your coaching journey. Can we speak about that final transition over the ocean and how you ended up working in the US as a coach?
Yeah. So it was interesting because I thoroughly, absolutely loved working with the U17 Academy boys back home. But when I was about to be finished with my PhD in 2007, I was tipped off about an academic job, a graduate school assistant director position at UNC Wilmington. And, you know, I kind of started okay, this would be the opportunity to go back. Because when I graduated from college, I always had the feeling like it'd be nice to go back one day and see what life in the States is like as an actual grown-up, not as a college student and an athlete, right? So I felt like that was the opportunity that I had to take, as much as it was painful to leave the club and the team that I was coaching. But I was offered a very good position in the academic world at UNC Wilmington. And then I really almost accidentally ended up coaching women's soccer. I knew the head coach for UNC Wilmington men and women. And, you know, they both knew that I had started coaching. I had my UEFA B license. I took the UEFA Pro B course. And it just happened to be that Paul, the women's head coach, asked me before Aiden, the men's head coach. And I started coaching. And fast forward, you know, 5 seasons, I'd been coaching with them. And then it came down to, you know, I had an academic job and I had a coaching position. And there's a reason why professors and Division I coaches are separate jobs. For me, it was like, okay, what are we doing? Are we going to go for it, or are we going to or we're going to keep doing this. And in Wilmington, you know, there's not a lot of opportunities in terms of if you want to be in the higher levels. So for me, that was the moment where I decided, like, okay, I'm going to leave the safe academic career behind and follow my heart and my passion for the game and step away from the academic world. Not entirely, but in terms of having a full-time job in the academic world and going straight into full-time coaching. So
you've had this interesting career where you've been able to sort of coach at many different levels. You had the U17 boys, collegiate, mm-hmm. women's, youth, yeah. now professional game on the men's side. Can you give us a sort of insight on all the different, a quick summary on some of the different levels and how the competitiveness changes and some of the routines and things that you're able to work on a daily basis?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a couple of things. One, I am very, very grateful that I've had the opportunity to coach at different levels. I've had conversations about this with a lot of people. And, you know, when you see someone going straight from their player career into coaching and they go into coaching at the senior level and you see them not successful, you see them going and getting fired and then going, getting another job because of their player background. And so it goes. I think one of the biggest reasons for that is that you have to grow to become a coach. It's very, very difficult to just all of a sudden become a coach if you've never been a coach. And if you're at the highest level, it's increasingly difficult because of all the things you have to be a master of. Not necessarily in execution if you have staff, but in terms of the areas that you have to be knowledgeable about. And when I've worked with the youth and I've worked with the college game and I've worked with the pro game, I don't think I've ever been at a place where we've had, you know, even among the best resources of our competitors. So I've had to become resourceful. I've had to really think through, okay, if this is what we want to work on, what do we have so that we can accomplish what we need to accomplish with the little bit that we have? So in some ways for me, nothing crucial has ever been different in the environments that I've worked in. I've been fortunate that I've been in environments where the players have always been of the highest caliber. You know, starting with the U17 boys, I had U15 and U16 national team players on those teams, you know, in the 3 years that I coached them. When I came across the pond and I was coaching at UNC Wilmington, we had young women who, I mean, we ended up winning the first ever conference title and getting to the NCAAs. But we had also young women who wanted to pursue the pro path, which, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, wasn't anywhere near as accessible as it is now, but we had several of the players go pro from a mid-major like UNC Wilmington. At Shattuck St. Mary's, you know, I had youth national team players from Germany, from New Zealand, from Belarus, from Finland, from Canada, from the US. And again, same thing at the University of Richmond. We had players who ended up going pro and having long careers on the pro level. So my point is this: I've been fortunate that I've had players of that caliber everywhere I've worked, and not necessarily already at the level, but caliber in terms of potential and ambition and the many things that you need in order to give yourself the best chance to become as good as you can. So for me, that's been a constant in all of the environments where I've coached. How I've coached, of course, it matters whether you're coaching a 15-year-old or a 32-year-old, because, you know, it's pedagogy and andragogy, you know, teaching children, teaching adults. So some things are different because you have to meet every person. So you need to find a way to relate to the player's situation, the player's experience. So you need to find the 15-year-old in you. And when I was coaching women, it was actually very, very rewarding for me that I had been raised by a single mom and a big sister, and I had a wife and a daughter, because I was able to find ways or connect more in relatable ways because I had the human experience to help me with the coaching experience. I hope that makes sense, because for me, the other thread in terms of, okay, what types of players have I been fortunate to work with? But the other one is, every environment where I've been, I've fully invested myself into it. Coaching is such a personal profession that I think you have to be genuine. You have to be authentic as yourself. And within it, you have to find a way, how do I as a human being connect with you as a human being, and then multiply that by the number of players you have. It's very demanding, very difficult, but for me, it's the only way to success. If I need to get the most out of you as a player on the field, if I know you a little bit better, it helps me know how you get there, and how you get there may be very different from how your teammate gets there. The better I know you, the more straightforward it becomes. It may not become easier, but it becomes more straightforward in terms of what am I going to try to do.
Yeah, it's like what you mentioned. You have to meet them where they're at, and I think that's sort of the key principle.
Yeah, yeah.
So we'll get into your time now at Richmond Kickers. Can you speak about your initial role in the process of actually onboarding at Richmond, and then how your role has now evolved over time?
Yeah. So initially, I was hired by the late David Bulow as the first assistant coach. And then relatively soon, I became the head assistant coach and director of player development and methodology because the club had an ambition to not just be a single team standalone club at the pro level. The club has always had ambition to do more in terms of community and involvement in the game and in the both the local community, but in the global community. So my role has really evolved with the club's ambition being actualized and materialized a little bit step by step. But I wouldn't be where I am unless I won the trust of the current chief soccer officer and head coach, Darren Sawatsky. When Darren was hired in November 2019, and he was told that he had to retain me on staff, I probably had, we've never really talked about specifics, but I probably had the year to show him why I'm worth keeping. Mm-hmm. And our first season together was the COVID season. So we got to know each other real fast. I think over that time period, I was able to demonstrate what I'm capable of doing. And then it's just been working with like-minded people on the technical side of things to see what we can do, where can we take this project. And I'm super excited about where we are currently in terms of what we've done in the last 12 months.
Yeah, we spoke about sort of your experience in the many different sectors of women's collegiate, professional, all the different routes.
Yeah.
Now you sort of have that chance to show off that experience working on the development pathway in terms of from the academy to the first team. Yeah. Can you speak about how that initial process has worked so far and where you sort of see it developing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've seen some clear, explicit signs of success early on. If I think back to the last 13 months, we've had our U17 boys win the national championship for ECNL. And across the board, actually, we had the most successful postseason in the history of Richmond United. We've signed two players from our academy to full professional contracts. We've signed five more to academy contracts. And, you know, when we were in Spokane, we had two 17-year-olds in the starting lineup.
Wow.
Our man of the match in that game was Griffin Garnett, who's a 17-year-old center back. He was ECNL Player of the Year last year. So we've had early signs of success, no question. But I feel, and I know Darren shares with me, that we've only scratched the surface because we don't really have the infrastructure or the structure or the community as a whole where we would like it to be yet. We're taking really good steps towards it. But if you think about it, the American way, for most of the clubs, you know, forget about the MLS clubs because they have a requirement to have an academy. But for most of the clubs, it's here's a pro club and that's it. Or here's your youth soccer club. Soccer's fun and it should always be fun. But for the majority of the players, there is nothing that they aspire to in terms of within our club, right? There's a youth soccer club and the travel elite will aspire to maybe play pro, aspire to go to college, right? So what we're trying to do, you know, MLS excluded, is actually really rare. Even if you look within the USL, there aren't a whole lot of clubs that have the full pathway. So we have a lot of work to do in terms of just educating our community, because it's not the North American way to do anything when it comes to team sports. You know, I'm sure you have people who's like, why do they have 17-year-olds in the starting lineup? Like, this is the men's game or whatever, right?
Yeah.
What we're about is we want to make sure that in our community, any kid, girls or boys, because we have the Richmond Ivy also in the pre-professional game, any girl or boy growing up in Richmond can actually have the dreams and the goals that I was telling you that I had in Europe, where, hey, I want to play in front of 5,000 people at City Stadium for our town, instead of thinking like more globally, I want to go to college, but where is that college? What's my actual connection to that college or another pro team? So creating all of that in my multiple roles with the help of the people that are part of our project is challenging, not because there's resistance. I mean, yeah, is there some resistance? Of course, whenever there's change, there's resistance to it by some, but it's more just the general education, because we don't have similar examples around us, right? Because if you think about what we're trying to do, yes, we're trying to develop players to the highest possible levels. And if they do, some of them are going to play for us on the pro team. But if we set the bar high for everybody, if we set the expectations for our operation high for everybody, then where they go to college is also going to improve. What they get out of the experience is going to be more similar to what I had, for example, growing up in Europe, where I felt like I was cared for by something bigger than myself, something greater than just the team and the coach for that year. And then so in the best case scenario, in what we're trying to do, everybody wins. The ones that never even want to play professional soccer will still get a better experience, because we're investing into the culture of holistic development, culture of the human aspect of it, while pursuing the highest levels. And Darren did that in Seattle when he helped build the Sounders Academy. And I've been part of that in where I grew up, both as a player and as a coach. And now we're here together. So my roles are, you know, I really have three roles formally. They're all very ingrained into the big project. But, you know, depending on the time of the day, it's a little bit different. So
I think at this stage, it's almost like a startup, a tech startup, for example. It's because it's so fresh and there's so much expansion in terms of the US game. I think you always have to have sort of multiple roles and try and balance them in order to help a team like Richmond Kickers grow in terms of the academy, the professional team, the women's side now building up in the area. I think you have all those different aspects.
Yeah, for sure.
So we'll get into, you hinted a little bit there. What does a day in the life actually look like for Mika? I know you have your multiple roles, but can you give a general idea of what you would be doing in a day?
Yeah. So as the head assistant, I typically spend, you know, the day from about 7:30 a.m. to 1-ish with the first team. You know, I have the most intense discussions with the head coach for the benefit of the team. That's the head assistant's job. You know, whether it's about training design, personnel management, whatever the team needs, right? I also oversee the IDP process in terms of, you know, how do we do the IDPs with the pro players, individual development plans with the pro players, and how do we do them with the academy players, and where do they meet? Because it's important that the work that is done in the academy is done in a way that actually helps the players take the right steps in their development to the next level. You know, in the role of director of methodology and player development, the IDP process is probably the most frequent and the regular one. But then it's also considering what type of players do we want to scout? You know, how do we do certain things in training? All of that. All of that is the early part of the day, you know, between 5.5, 6 hours. Then I get home and I actually, you know, on some days I teach the U.S. Soccer Federation a senior license. So I have virtual calls with the federation catch up on emails, you know, in the middle part of the day. And then in the evenings, I usually go to one of the sites for our academy training. I go observe the coaches and the players. I do IDP work. And then when I'm at home, I'll still do some session planning sometimes or video analysis for the first team. So it's kind of from dawn to dusk, with some random breaks in the middle. I think that's the best way to describe what I do. You know, as the technical director, my main job is to coach the coaches, set expectations and benchmarks for player development, oversee everything really related to the style of play, what we prioritize in development and training, how we do things. And, you know, the only way to keep things manageable for me, I think, is really kind of twofold. You know, I have to devote certain parts of the day to each, but then I also really just have to take everything coming at me all at once. Because if I deflect too much, then at some point there's a huge volume of things that I have to attend to. So kind of real-time juggling of what I can deflect and, you know, what has to wait and what is most important right now. It's sometimes an interesting process, but that's a typical day in the life, no, I guess.
Yeah, no, it's always difficult, especially with multiple roles, to actually describe what you're doing, because every day looks so different. We'll get into some of the Insider's Lounge favorites, I call them. We ask them to each guest. So the first one is, the football industry is a roller coaster of emotions. I'm sure you knew playing and even during your managerial side, where you have these constant highs and lows, and they're quite extreme. Did you have a low in your career, in terms of, it could be your playing career, your personal life, or even now, a low point that kind of helps motivate you day to day at a later stage? So you just, you're really down in the dust, but now you're able to look back at that and use it as motivation to help you move forward.
Professionally, no. I've never really thought of myself or my career methodically in terms of, this is where I have to get to next. This is where I want to be. The positions that I've had, I think, have been, at the time, they've been a good fit, and I've been excited about each of them. I've turned down offers for jobs elsewhere while being on jobs, but I don't think I've ever had a professional moment like that. Unfortunately, I've had to deal with a lot in life. You know, I lost my parents when I was 28. It was my final season of playing. I've had to deal with a lot of things in life that were not in my control, that I have such gratitude for my life, you know, my family, for my career, that I don't think I've ever had anything that would have totally just deflated or discouraged me professionally. You know, I think the difficulties or the hard times in life that I've had to deal with have just allowed me to keep the perspective of gratitude and service as a coach. I know it doesn't really answer your question, but I can't think of such a dramatically challenging time period professionally, you know?
No, I think it hints to the mentality that you have, that if you can't control the circumstances, then it's much easier to not worry about it and move forward, and you can use your career to help you do that. And now you have a strong family unit as well. And I think that those both points are clear.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, twice in my career, I've been the head assistant when the head coach has been let go, you know, and I think during those moments, the reality of the volatility that, you know, the short tenures of coaches is a reminder, but each time, I stayed, you know, I stayed, one, because the players deserve for me to be there for as long as I was allowed to. But then number two, I also stayed because the incoming head coach wanted to keep me. So you could see that those were challenges, but at the same time, it was just a different kind of day because of what happened. And I just, you know, you don't prove anything as a reaction to the moment, right? I don't think if I hadn't done the work that I had done up until that point, I don't think in either environment, the administration would have said, hey, you need to keep Mika, right? So I guess those would count as the moments because they are moments that many coaches do experience. And unfortunately, a lot of times it's like when the head coach is gone, you're gone as well. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't have to be like that, I guess, is what I'm saying. So,
and if someone's looking at your career or listening to this episode and gets inspiration from it, do you have any advice for someone in that position that might be aspiring to work in a role similar to yours now?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much. I would say the number one thing is you absolutely have to love the sport if you want to stay in the business. Whether you're on the technical side or in the front office, that's up to you, who you are, right? Mm. But as they say, it is a grind. And if you want to make a career out of it, it's you're going to have to actually embrace the grind and understand that there may be, you may need to be able to take a phone call at 6 a.m. in the morning or 11 o'clock at night. You know, your player's wife may be having some stuff going on and you may need to be the one who he leans to because he doesn't have anybody else or whatever. You know, you have to be prepared to do what it takes so that the team succeeds. And it's very much about the people. It's not about how you kick the ball or how you keep the ball from the opponent or whatever. And if you're not willing to do it, if you don't love the game, at some point it's just going to become a quote unquote job. But it can't be just a job. It has to be a lifestyle, and it can't be like, hey, I'm okay, I'm compromising, I'm sacrificing. No, I'm so lucky to get to do what I do, because if you think about it, let's imagine the world in 2024. Mm-hmm. So much has changed, right? But for a lot of people, millions of people around the world, United States of America is still the shining light, the land of opportunities they dream of, right? For some people, it's just a visit, not to mention to actually get to live here. And then you combine that with the world's game, when everybody knows that the world is crazy about the game. When I get to work in the game I love in a country that truly is the land of opportunity, I have to, one, be incredibly grateful, respect the opportunity that I have. And then the way you pay that back is by working tirelessly for the players. The question I ask most from the coaches that I have in the academy is, what do the players deserve? They don't deserve for you to feel down. They don't deserve for you to feel like, oh, I can't, you know, this or that. No, they are young players who deserve for you to be the most enthusiastic, the most excited, the most professional coach you can be. Now, none of us can be that all the time, every day, right? But if that's at the heart of what you're doing and how you're doing it, you know, that's it's only possible if you love the game, because every job has tough days, tough times, you know, but the players deserve nothing less from you. And if you do that, you'll find that whatever it is that you're good at and passionate about within the sport, and then you'll have a career. And sometimes, you know, it means that you may need to take a pay cut to get the position you want. You know, I think that's actually one of my biggest challenges, is being that how to promote myself to you know, to best find and grab what's out there. Like, I've made all kinds of decisions in my career, including coaching voluntarily, taking a pay cut because the position was what I thought was a better fit.
Because it's always coaching been, conferences, for example, that's another example.
Yeah. And you know, because it's always been about what's best for me and my family, not just what's best for what appears to be best for my career. You know, if I really wanted to go and think like, oh, I need to be a head coach and I need to do this, and taking jobs where our daily life as a family would have been seriously affected, I wouldn't be as happy as I am. I know that I wouldn't have been as successful as the players would have deserved for me to be, because if I compromise for my family, if I move the family somewhere just for me, that's we're doing things where it's good for one and not good for four out of the five, right? So, and it may mean that I've missed out on some quote unquote bigger jobs, if you will, but I have an amazing family and an incredibly supporting wife. So the jobs that I've had, I've felt I've left every place better than I found it because of the tireless work that I've done, and I've created some unbelievable connections with people. So I think those three, you know, if I try to synthesize my own blurb here, you know, one, you have to love the sport. You have to be in it for others. You have to have the attitude of we're serving, we're doing this for the players. And then the, you know, number three should be, it shouldn't be about the money. It shouldn't be, of course, money has to work. You have to live, but it should be about the human side of you and your life and the human side of those that you work with.
Yeah. Last point is the work-life balance, which I think is so important no matter your industry.
100%. It is important, but at the same time, when it's a lifestyle, if you set an expectation for some kind of a balance, I don't know that it's always fair because it is such a difficult industry to be a part of. You're going to have your, like right now, next time I'm going to have an actual day off is going to be in November. It's what it is, you know? And, you know, as a coach, are you going to have a day off? Of course you can have a day off, but it's really an off day for the players. And if you're doing the best you can, you're at least thinking about what do we need to do? What do we need to adjust? Right.
So yeah, no, you're spot on there. We spoke a little bit about it, and you mentioned how you never really look for what your next step is in terms of your career. You're more focused on the present, but we always ask this question. I like to get the idea of how you think. If we sat down and had the same conversation in 5-10 years time, where do you see yourself in terms of your career, your personal life, and kind of how do you see yourself grow?
I had no idea. I mean, hopefully somewhere healthy and happy, getting ready to go watch one of my kids' pro games or see a movie my daughter just finished shooting, you know, three kids. So one of them is pursuing a career in the TV and movie industry, and the two others are soccer players. So that would be the number one thing. Hopefully I'm somewhere getting ready to go watch, you know, one of the two footballers play a game or watch something that my daughter just finished shooting. Work-wise, I hope I'm still in the game actively and ambitiously grinding. You know, I'm sure I'll be involved in education, coaching education and player development, probably in some capacity, but what that position looks like, could be a head coach somewhere on planet Earth, or maybe working full time for a federation. I don't think it's reasonable to expect that I'm going to go somewhere predictable, because if you look back on how I came here, you know, my diverse path, if you will, the role that I have right now, you know, pro game, academy technical director, and then U.S. Soccer Federation coaching educator. I don't know that I could have ever predicted that this is where I'm going to be now, not even 5 years ago. But I am, and I'm incredibly grateful for the opportunity to serve in all three of those roles. So I would love to talk to you in 5 years. I would like to be relevant enough to still for you to want to talk to me. How about that one for the last piece?
There we go. No, we got to book it in the calendar, and I'll make sure to reach out. We'll wrap up here with some quick fire questions. What was your favorite club growing up?
Erste FC Köln and Newcastle United.
Favorite quote or saying that you live by?
Two. I'm looking at one of them. It's from Yoda. Do or do not, there is no try. And another one is from William Shakespeare. It goes, have more than thou showest, speak less than thou knowest.
Those are strong. I really like those. Top recommendations for Richmond or Finland, a food choice, a place you have to go see, something that's just really appealing.
Let's go with Richmond first. Mekong, great Vietnamese restaurant. Looks like a hole in the wall. Incredible. A regular place that I go to, but also take people from out of town to. Portico, an Italian restaurant and a beautiful setting. Also great. Pony Pasture, which is an area where people can just go and spend time by the river. Incredible. Very, very Richmond. Kerrytown is a cool place to walk around and you know, pop into cafes, pubs, restaurants, whatever it is that you're looking for. Also small boutiques and even a record store. Can you believe that? Finland, we're going to probably have to go bigger in terms of maybe not as specifics, you know, visit Arctic Circle in the summer, the kind of the Northeast in the winter. You gotta go to a sauna by a lake, you know, swim in a lake or river in the heart of the city because it's so clean that you can swim anywhere. Try some reindeer stew, rye bread, fresh berries that you can pick from any forest.
All right, I've got a good list there. I'll keep that in mind. Are you a reader? Do you have a favorite book that you've read?
If I could show you my library that my wife would rather not have, you would know the answer. I love reading. So, favorite book? Oh, wow. Definitely one of them is The Things They Carried by Tim O'Brien, without a doubt. I've read that multiple times. The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho, for sure. The Dharma Bums by Jack Kerouac. The Long Walk that Stephen King wrote under the pseudonym Richard Bachman. James O'Barr's The Crow. That inspired the movie The Crow. That's a graphic novel, but that's off the top of my head.
Yeah, you've got a good diverse range of books there. And the second last one here, do you have any hobbies to sort of break away from football if you just want to take a break and go do something else for a little bit?
Yeah, good luck with that when I have two kids also who play. And I mean, our family is sports nut. So, I mean, my wife was a former very, very high-level gymnast. And both of the daughters also did gymnastics for a long time. So sport is definitely something that I enjoy, going to different sporting events. I don't care what sport it is. We love going to sporting events to watch. Live music probably is hands down it for me in terms of going to concerts. If it's the right band, I don't care if anyone else wants to go. I'll go alone. I've gone to concerts alone, and I'd rather go to a concert alone than with someone who just wants to go to the bar and drink, because I'm there for the music. I'm there to support the incredible artistry and musicianship of the band. So and stand-up comedy too. I need the release and the relief, you know, from comedy, from music. Those are really the only spaces where I can actually escape my head as well, because the game goes with me wherever I go.
No, I like that. That's a good one. And the last one here, if you could sit down with one person, so we've expanded this to three people because people find it difficult.
Yeah, of course,
If you could sit down with three people, dead or alive, who would it be and why? And that can be like most people do, a football figure and then just two from wherever.
Yeah, this is a tough one. I'm sure everybody tells you how hard it is, and that's why you've expanded it to three.
That's how I've done it,
You could go to so many different directions. I would probably go with dead people. I think Jesus would have to be one, because, you know, why? Because if I actually had the opportunity to talk and ask the real questions, I mean, why wouldn't I take it? I mean, if you think about a person who's influenced the whole world one way or the other, you know, that conversation would be unbelievable to have, you know, completely different in so many ways, but I would love to have a conversation with Kobe Bryant. I think people have learned more about Kobe Bryant since his passing than they did during his lifetime.
Yeah, definitely.
But I would be very interested in, again, having an open conversation about everything with him. Those would be two that just come to my mind right now, but again, like I could go to so many places with that. But a very, very cool question.
No, that's great. We'll stick with the two.
Yeah,
I like that.
Yeah.
Is there any last words you have before we wrap things up?
No, I mean, very, very grateful for the opportunity. I enjoyed the conversation. I enjoyed the questions. Whenever I have an opportunity to share from my background, players who've played for me know that I take the opportunity, and I do so because I do think that anecdotes and shared experiences can help people along the way without being too explicitly about, you know, directive advice. So thank you for the opportunity to share from my story. And we left quite a few hanging there for, you know, maybe next time we see each other, we'll chat more over coffee. But incredibly grateful and humbled by your request to be here.
Definitely. I really appreciate your time, and I look forward to speaking again.
Thank you, Chad, very much. Enjoy the rest of your day, and thank you for everyone who listened.